Palestinians hold a funeral for a 13-year-old boy who was gunned down by Israeli soldiers in the occupied West Bank. Yemeni officials slam Saudi Arabia for refusing to allow three fuel ships to dock at the Hodeidah port despite securing UN clearance. Russia registered more than 41,000 new daily coronavirus infections, the highest number of cases since the beginning of the pandemic. Hello and welcome from our international studios right here in Tehran. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, Palestinians have laid to rest the body of a teenager killed by Israeli fire during clashes in the West Bank city of Nablus on Friday. Mohammed Dadis succumbed to his injuries he sustained after he was shot in the abdomen in the village of Beit Dajan. Many others were also injured in the clashes. That after protesters threw rocks at Israeli forces in the area to voice their anger at the regime's settlement construction. Well, the troops responded with live fire. Palestinian towns have been the scene of protests for months over the regime's settlement activities and planned eviction of families from their ancestral homes. Dozens of people have been killed and many others wounded in the Israeli crackdown on protests this year. Earlier, we were joined by our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Candil, for the latest on the killing of a Palestinian teenager by Israeli forces and his funeral.
Well, anti-Israeli settlement protests continue to take place almost on a weekly basis. On Fridays, following Friday prayers, Palestinians take part in demonstrations and protests close to the illegal settlements to demand the Israeli regime stop settlement activity and evacuate the illegal settlement. What happened yesterday is that during a protest in the village of Beit Dajan near Nablus, in northern occupied West Bank, Israeli forces opened a fire and shot 13-year-old Mohammed Dadas from the refugee camp of Askar. It took place in Beit Dajan. He was transferred to hospital. However, the doctors couldn't risk his life, and he succumbed to his injuries. Others were wounded in Beit Dajan, in Beita, in other places near the occupied West Bank city of Nablus, also during demonstrations. Today, thousands of Palestinians took part in the funeral processions of this Palestinian child, Mohammed Dadas, in the refugee camp of Askar in Nablus. They vowed to avenge the killing of this Palestinian child, and they also said they would continue anti-Israel activities, and they would continue to take part in the protests and demonstrations that take place against the Israeli settlements.
Well, Yemen's petroleum company has slammed Saudi Arabia for its refusal to allow three ships carrying fuel to dock at the Hodeidah port. In a statement, the company says the Saudi-led coalition seized the tankers nearly 3 months ago, despite the vessels having secured UN clearance for sailing in international waters. It says the country is in need of fuel to continue its public services. Yemen has been mired in a war and blockade imposed by Saudi Arabia since 2015. Now, the war has killed tens of thousands of people and has destroyed its vital infrastructure. The UN says more than 24 million Yemenis are in dire need of humanitarian aid, calling the situation there the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Meanwhile, Yemen's Ansar Allah movement has condemned the new U.S. arms deal with Saudi Arabia as a show of Washington's continued support for Riyadh's warmongering. A senior member of Yemen's Supreme Political Council says the deal contradicts U.S. President Joe Biden's stated commitment to peace in Yemen. Abdul Latif Awashali reports.
A senior member of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Mohammed Al-Houthi, has slammed the recent U.S. arms sale to Saudi Arabia, saying it confirms the contradiction in Biden's administration when it comes to Yemen. In a tweet, Al-Houthi said the arms sales once again prove that the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden had no real intention to stop the support for the Saudi-led war on Yemen.
America.
The United States is leading the war on Yemen and supports the Saudi-led coalition logistically and militarily. Washington's claims that it would stop the war on Yemen are incorrect, and the evidence for that is the continuation of the U.S. support for terrorist groups across the country. And this was proved through what the Yemeni army found in Al-Qaeda weapons warehouses with USAID logos.
Observers say Biden's promises to stop the war on Yemen have been nothing but lies to gain more votes in the elections. They say the new U.S. missiles sold to Riyadh will be used to bomb Yemenis and fighter jets such as F-15 and not as defensive weapons, contrary to what Washington claims.
The pre-election statements of the U.S. administration were only aimed at winning more votes, and the promises that the support for the Saudi regime and the war on Yemen would be halted were false. The U.S. administration proved that it supports the Saudi regime and that it only seeks to earn more money. The new deal is for offensive weapons. So the new U.S. administration is directly contributing to killing more Yemenis.
Saudi Arabia, with Washington's support, launched a deadly war on Yemen in March 2015. Over the years, the kingdom has used internationally prohibited weapons, including the U.S. cluster bombs, to target residential areas, according to the Cluster Ammunition Monitor.
Yemenis have long been accusing the U.S. of being the main supporter of the brutal Saudi-led war on their country. People here say they will continue to support Yemen's armed forces, as the armed struggle seems to be the only way to force Riyadh to stop its years-long war and siege. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Hashtag Trending brings you the Internet's reaction to the story of IRGC forces thwarting a U.S. attempt to seize an Iranian fuel shipment in the Sea of Oman.
Hello everyone, welcome to another Hashtag Trending. I'm Sarah Adema, and today we will be viewing the internet's reaction to the story of IRGC forces thwarting a U.S. attempt to seize an Iranian fuel shipment in the Sea of Oman. Stay with me. So, by now, you must have heard the whole story, but just in case, here is everything you need to know in less than 20 seconds. So, late in October, Americans confiscated a tanker carrying Iranian oil and transferred its consignment to another vessel. The IRGC then staged a multi-layered maritime operation and managed to navigate the ship towards Iranian waters. It's interesting to note that while the IRGC commandos were carrying out the operation Take Back What Belongs to Us, the two American destroyers sailing close by were forced to back away with their tails between their legs. Alright, now let's get on with your comments. Our first tweet of the day comes from Ayar. He says, "Never approach Iranian tankers again. Is the lesson learned, or we continue?" Alright, history tells us that the Americans are slow learners when it comes to the political arena and battlefields, so let's just hope they won't make the same mistakes or else. We have another comment by Adam. He says, "If you are wise, you will never underestimate the power of Iran again. Hashtag lesson learned." Alright, let me give you some background information on these pictures right here. These fellas are American Marines being arrested by the IRGC commandos back in 2016. We have another comment by Negin Razavi. She says, "Real authority vs. false authority. Hashtag lesson learned." Alright, just as the saying goes, a picture is worth a thousand words. Just so you know, after the IRGC forces pulled off the Heliborn operation successfully, several U.S. choppers and warships started chasing the vessel but fell short of capturing it when it entered the Iranian waters. We have a tweet here from Press TV. It reads, "Photo shows IRGC commandos standing dauntlessly in front of the American destroyer during a successful operation that foiled U.S. attempt to steal Iranian oil in the Sea of Oman." Alright, these casual poster that these soldiers are assuming, especially the one in the middle, leaves no room for any speculation of who had the upper hand in the whole incident. We have another comment by Ken that reads, "This is no surprise. White supremacists have stolen everything they got their hands on. We have another tweet by Daniel. He says, I support the Iranian right to defend itself and its properties. Another comment by Covinci says, someone should inform the American people that this is what actual self-defense looks like. But bombing millions of Libyan, Afghan, Syrian, Yemeni, and Iraqi citizens to death. That's a fair point. Let me add one of my own. Iranians have time and again shown to the world that they are a force to be reckoned within the Persian Gulf and the Oman Sea. There is no reason for the Americans to be present in those waters in the first place. But then again, Americans seem to be slow learners. All right, now let's read some of your comments on our website. U.S. Navy says, IRGC will give the U.S. terrorist Navy a new type of shakedown if they keep up the piracy. Another comment by Cora says, the USA overthrew democratic governments all over the world and involved many coups against governments, but they called it international law. We have another comment by Truth Hurts. They say, the US should be banned from entering the Persian Gulf and the Sea of Oman. They can play their dangerous games and plundering of people's resources in Florida, Gulf of Mexico. This is not North America. Or do they also steal from American citizens? Because once a thief, always a thief. Another comment by JJ says, the USA has fewer options against Iran every day now, as did US national debt balloons. Even simple resistance confounds the American military and undermines the apartheid colonial entity called Israel, pushing it step by step toward collapse. That's it for today's edition of the program. I'll see you next time, and until then, stay safe and bye-bye.
Well, Iran has stressed that it will seriously attend the upcoming Vienna talks with the remaining parties to the 2015 nuclear deal. Tehran says it will return to full compliance with the agreement if the U.S. fully implements its obligations and refrains from making demands outside of the scope of the deal. In a phone call with his Russian counterpart, the Iranian foreign minister urged the Europeans and the U.S. to adopt a realistic and constructive stance. Hossein Amir Abdullahian, however, pointed to the recent U.S. sanctions against Iran's drone program, saying Tehran is skeptical about Washington's motives. Also, Sergei Lavrov said all sides should resume implementing the deal, with the U.S. having to do so first. He underlined Russia's stance that the U.S. should cease its destructive approach with regards to the deal. Well, the Vienna talks are set to begin on November the 29th. Meanwhile, Iran is pushing ahead with its coronavirus vaccination campaign. Nearly 885,000 doses have been administered over the past day, raising the overall figure to above 93.5 million. Nearly 55 million Iranians have received their first shots, while over 38 million have had their second. Also, 150,000 people have gotten their booster shots. Iran has seen a decline in its coronavirus death rate amid the mass vaccination campaign. The country has reported its lowest daily deaths since late June, with 120 fatalities. New infections also stood at a five-month low of just over 6,800. Health officials, however, have warned against any complacency and demands that the public continue to observe health protocols. Since the beginning of the pandemic, nearly 6 million Iranians have tested positive for the virus. The death toll has topped 127,000. And European countries continue to battle the spread of the coronavirus as the number of infections and deaths soar across the continent. Ukraine reported a record number of COVID-related deaths, with 793 fatalities during the past day. Over 25,000 new infections were also reported. Meanwhile, Russian health officials registered over 41,300 new cases. That is the highest number of new infections since the start of the pandemic. There were nearly 1,190 COVID-related deaths on Saturday also. Elsewhere in Europe, Germany witnessed another rise in cases, reporting over 34,000 new infections and 142 new related deaths. The World Health Organization says Europe is once again the epicenter of the pandemic as cases and deaths are on the rise. Now turning to Germany, where a knife attack on an express train has left several people injured. None of the injuries are life-threatening. German police say the alleged perpetrator has been arrested. However, the motive for the attack is still unclear. Local newspapers say the suspect is a 27-year-old man of Arab origin who may be suffering from psychiatric problems. Well, the attack happened in the early hours today on a train traveling between two southern cities in Germany. Well, some 100 people have died in a fuel tanker explosion in Sierra Leone's capital, Freetown. Authorities in the West African country say the incident occurred in a densely populated suburb late on Friday. Tens of people have also been injured and transferred to the hospital. Several are in critical condition. Well, that's according to the country's National Disaster Management Agency. Freetown's mayor has cited that a collision with another truck at a busy junction as the cause of the incident. This is the second major fire incident in the capital, Freetown, this year. In March, over 1,000 people lost their lives in a fire that engulfed the city's slums. And with that brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin. Stay tuned, please.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The cause and consequences of America's 21st century wars have by now been well documented. A staggering $8 trillion in expenditures and more than 380,000 civilian deaths, as calculated by Brown University's Cost of War project. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by William D. Hartung, writer. This article is published under the heading Corporate America Cashed In on Post-9/11 Pentagon Spending Surge. Stay tuned for the details, please. The cause and consequences of America's 21st century wars have by now been well documented. A staggering $8 trillion in expenditures and more than 380,000 civilian deaths as calculated by Brown University's Cost of War project. The question of who has benefited most from such military spending, unfortunately, has received far less attention. Corporations large and small have left the financial feast of that post-9/11 surge in military spending with genuinely staggering sums in hand. After all, Pentagon spending has totaled an almost unimaginable $14 trillion plus since the start of the Afghan war in 2001, up to one half of which, catch a breath here, went directly to defense contractors. The political climate created by the global so-called War on Terror, or GWOT, as Bush administration officials quickly dubbed it, set the stage for homogeneous increases in the Pentagon budget. In the first year after the 9/11 attacks and the invasion of Afghanistan, defense spending rose by more than 10%, and that was just the beginning. It would in fact increase annually for the next decade, which was unprecedented in the American history. The Pentagon budget peaked in 2010 at the highest level since the Second World War, over $800 million, substantially more than the country spent on its forces at the height of the Korean or Vietnam Wars during President Ronald Reagan's rounded military buildup of 1980s. And in the new political climate sparked by the reaction to the 9/11 attacks, those increases reached well beyond expenditures specifically tied to fighting and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. As Harry Stonecipher, then vice president of Boeing, told the Wall Street Journal in an October 2001 interview, "The purse is now open. Any member of Congress who doesn't vote for the funds we need to defend this country will be looking for a new job after next November." Stonecipher's prophecy of rapidly rising Pentagon budget proved correct, and it's never ended. The Biden administration is anything but an exception. Its latest proposal for spending on the Pentagon and related defense work like nuclear warhead development at the Department of Energy topped $753 billion for FY 2022. And not to be outdone, the House and Senate Armed Services Committees have already voted to add roughly $24 billion to that staggering sum. And who benefited? The benefits of the post 9/11 surge in Pentagon spending have been distributed in a highly concentrated fashion. More than one-third of all contracts now go to just five major weapons companies, including Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, Raytheon, and Northrop Grumman. Those five received more than $166 billion in such contracts in fiscal year 2020 alone. To put such a figure in perspective, the $75 billion in Pentagon contracts awarded to Lockheed Martin that year was significantly more than 1.5 times the entire 2020 budget for the State Department and the Agency for International Development, which together totaled $44 billion. While it's true that the biggest financial beneficiaries of the post 9/11 military spending surge were those five weapons contractors, they were anything but the only ones to cash in. Companies benefiting from the buildup of the past 20 years also included logistics and construction firms like Kellogg, Brown & Root, KBR, and Bechtel, as well as armed private security contractors like Blackwater and DynCorp. The Congressional Research Service estimates that in FY 2020, the spending for contractors of all kinds had grown to $420 billion, or well, half of the total Pentagon budget. Companies in all three categories noted above took advantage of wartime conditions in which both the speed of delivery and less rigorous oversight came to be considered the norms, to overcharge the government or even engage in outright fraud. The best-known reconstruction and logistics contractor in Iraq and Afghanistan was Halliburton, through its KBR subsidiary. At the start of both the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, Halliburton was the recipient of the Pentagon's Logistics Civil Augmentation Program contracts. Those open-ended arrangements involved coordinating support functions for troops in the field, including setting up military bases, maintaining equipment, and providing food and laundry services. By 2008, the company had received more than $30 billion for such work. Halliburton's role would prove controversial indeed, reeking as it did of self-dealing and blatant corruption. The notion of privatizing military support services was first initiated in early 1990s by Dick Cheney, which he was Secretary of Defense in the George H.W. Bush administration, and Halliburton got the contract to figure out how to do it. We suspect you won't be surprised to learn that Cheney then went on to serve as the CEO of Halliburton until he became vice president under George W. Bush in 2001. His journey was, if not the classic case of that revolving door between the Pentagon and the defense industry, now used by so many government officials and generals or admirals, with all the obvious conflicts of interest it entails. Once it secured its billions for work in Iraq, Halliburton proceeded to vastly overcharge the Pentagon for basic services, even while doing shoddy work that put U.S. troops at risk. And it would prove to be anything but alone in such activities. Starting in 2004, a year into the Iraq War, the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction, a controversially congressionally mandated body designed to root out waste, fraud, and abuse, along with congressional watchdogs like Representative Henry Waxman, exposed scores of examples of overcharging, faulty construction, and outright theft by contractors engaged in the rebuilding of that country. Again, you undoubtedly won't be surprised to find out that relatively few companies suffered significant financial or criminal consequences for what can only be described as striking war profiteering. The Congressional Commission on Wartime Contracting in Iraq and Afghanistan estimated that as of 2011, waste, fraud, and abuse in two war zones had already totaled $31 billion to $60 billion. Case in point was the International Oil Trading Company, which received contracts worth $2.7 billion from the Pentagon's Defense Logistics Agency to provide fuel for U.S. operations in Iraq. An investigation by Congressman Waxman, chair of the House Government Oversight and Reform Committee, found that the firm had routinely overcharged the Pentagon for the fuel it shipped into Iraq, making more $200 million in profits on oil sales of $1.4 billion during the period from 2004 to 2008. More than a third of those funds went to its owner, Harry Sargent III, who also served as the finance chairman of the Florida Republican Party, and Waxman summarized the situation in this way. The documents show that Mr. Sargent's company took advantage of U.S. taxpayers. His company had the only license to transport fuel through Jordan, so he could get away with charging exorbitant prices. He never seen such a situation. A particularly egregious case of shoddy work with tragic human consequences involved the electrocution of at least 18 military personnel at several bases in Iraq from 2004 on. This happened thanks to faulty electrical installations, some done by KBR and its subcontractors. An investigation by the Pentagon's Inspector General found that commanders in the field had failed to ensure that renovations had been properly done, the Army did not set standards for jobs or contractors, and KBR did not ground electrical equipment it installed at the facility. The Afghan reconstruction process was similarly replete with examples of fraud, waste, and abuse. These included a U.S.-appointed economic task force that spent $43 million constructing a gas station essentially in the middle of nowhere that would never be used, another $150 million on lavish living quarters for U.S. economic advisors, and $3 million for Afghan police patrol boats that would prove similarly useless. Perhaps most disturbingly, a congressional investigation found that a significant portion of $2 billion worth of transportation contracts issued to U.S. and Afghan firms ended up as kickbacks to warlords and police officials or as payments to the Taliban to allow large convoys of trucks to pass through areas they controlled, sometimes as much as $1,500 per truck or up to $500,000 for each 300-truck convoy. In 2009, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton stated that one of the major sources of funding for the Taliban is the protection money paid from just such transportation contracts. A second stream of revenue for corporations tied to those wars went to private security contractors, some of which guarded U.S. facilities or critical infrastructure like Iraqi oil pipelines. The most notorious of them all was, of course, Blackwater, a number of whose employees were involved in a 2007 massacre of 17 Iraqis in Baghdad's Nisour Square. They opened fire on civilians at a crowded intersection while guarding a U.S. embassy convoy. The attack prompted ongoing legal and civil cases that continued into the Trump era, when several perpetrators of the massacre were pardoned by the president. In the wake of those killings, Blackwater was rebranded several times, first as XE Services and then as Academy, before eventually merging with the Triple Canopy, another private contracting firm. Blackwater founder Eric Prince then separated from the company, but he has since recruited private mercenaries on behalf of the United Arab Emirates for deployment to the civil war in Libya in violation of a United Nations arms embargo. Prince also unsuccessfully proposed to the Trump administration that he recruit a force of private contractors meant to be the backbone of the U.S. war effort in Afghanistan. Another task taken up by private firms Titan and CACI International was the interrogation of Iraqi prisoners. Both companies had interrogators and translators on the ground about Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq, a site where such prisoners were brutally tortured. The number of personnel deployed and the revenues received by security and reconstruction contractors grew dramatically as the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan wore on. The Congressional Research Service estimated that by March 2011, there were more contractor employees in Iraq and Afghanistan, that is about 155,000, than American uniform military personnel, that is 145,000. In its August 2011 final report, the Commission on Wartime Contracting in Iraq and Afghanistan put the figure even higher, stating that contractors represent more than half of the U.S. presence in the contingency operations in Iraq and Afghanistan and at times employing more than a quarter million people. While an armed contractor who had served in the Marines could earn as much as $200,000 annually in Iraq, about three-quarters of the contractor workforce there was made up of people from countries like Nepal or the Philippines or Iraqi citizens. Poorly paid, at times they received as little as $3,000 per year. A 2017 analysis by the Cost of War Project documented abysmal labor conditions and major human rights abuses inflicted on foreign nationals working on the U.S.-funded projections in Afghanistan, including false imprisonment, theft of wages, and death and injuries in areas of conflict. With the U.S. military in Iraq reduced to a relatively modest number of armed advisors and no American forces left in Afghanistan, such contractors are now seeking foreign clients. For example, a U.S. firm, Tire One Group, which was founded by a former employee of Blackwater, trained four of the Saudi operatives involved in the murder of a Saudi journalist and U.S. resident Jamal Khashoggi, an effort funded by the Saudi regime. As the New York Times noted when it broke that story, such issues are likely to continue as American private military contractors increasingly look to foreign clients to shore up their business as the United States scales back overseas deployments after two decades of war. Adding one more factor to the two-decade so-called war on terror, explosion of corporate profits. Overseas arms sales also rose sharply in this era. The biggest and most controversial market for U.S. weaponry in recent years has been the West Asia-North Africa region, particularly sales to countries like Saudi Arabia and the UAE regimes, which have been involved in a devastating war in Yemen, as well as fueling conflicts elsewhere in the region. Donald Trump made the most noise about the West Asia arms sales and their benefits to U.S. economy. However, the giant weapons-producing corporations actually sold more weaponry to Saudi Arabia on average during the Obama administration, including three major offers in 2010 that totaled more than $60 billion for combat aircraft, attack helicopters, armored vehicles, bombs, missiles, and guns, virtually an entire arsenal. Many of those systems were used by the Saudis in their intervention in Yemen, which has now involved the killing of thousands of civilians in indiscriminate airstrikes and the imposition of a blockade that contributed substantially to the death of nearly a quarter of a million people to date. Reining in the excess profits of weapons contractors and preventing waste, fraud, and abuse by private firms involved in supporting U.S. military operations will ultimately require reduced spending on war and our preparations for war. So far, unfortunately, Pentagon budgets only continue to rise and yet more money flows to the big five weapons firms. To alter this remarkably unvarying pattern, a new strategy is needed, one that increases the role of American diplomacy while focusing on emerging and persistent non-military security challenges. National security needs to be redefined, not in terms of a new Cold War with China, but to forefront crucial issues like pandemics and climate change. It's time to put a halt to the direct and indirect foreign military interventions the United States regime has carried out in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Somalia, Yemen, and so many other places in this century. Otherwise, we are in for decades of more war profiteering by weapons contractors reaping massive profits with impunity.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now let's listen to Sheikh Salim Bimji.
Tonight we want to try and unpack this topic of how do we lead a God-centric life. So three steps, and obviously there's much more, but this will hopefully get us on the path of becoming God-centric, about how having Allah in the middle of our lives rather than at the edge of our existence. Number one is that we have to recognize our prime goal of creation. Why were we created by Allah? أَفَحَسِبْتُمْ أَنَّمَا خَلَقْنَاكُمْ عَبَثًا? Were we created just for the heck of it? To live, enjoy, and die? No, we have to realize what our purpose of creation is. That's to serve, to know, to worship Allah. He says in Surah Al-Dhariyat, chapter 51, verse 56, وَمَا خَلَقْتُ الْجِنَّ وَالْإِنسِ إِلَّا لِيَعْبُدُونَ. I did not create the jinn and humanity except to worship me. And as the Ahlul Bayt would say, لِيَعْبُدُونَ أَيْ لِيَعْرِفُونَ. To know Allah, to have ma'rifatullah. Because when you know Allah, then you can begin to adore Allah, to worship Allah, to submit to Allah. So we have to first of all recognize our prime goal in life is to recognize Allah. We then have to go to the second stage to recognize that it is in our benefit to know and recognize and worship and submit to Allah. Not only in this world, but more importantly in the world to come. We have to realize, brothers and sisters, that this religion that Allah has given us, yes, it has benefits in this world. And, you know, there's many benefits that we could look at. But even if there was no benefit to worshiping Allah today, if you were to read or you were to be told that there is no reason that you should pray to Allah in this world, everything will be coming in the world to come. There's no benefit to eating halal meat in this world. All the benefits are in the world to come. There is no benefit from keeping away from alcohol or drugs in this world. Everything is in the world to come. That would be enough for us to say, well, you know what? If that's there, that's enough for me. You know. Actually, even if we were to say that Allah told me to do it, so that's enough for me, that's better. But if we're not at that stage, at least the second level. So what does Allah say in chapter Fussilat, verse 41, or chapter 41, rather, verse 46? Allah says, "Man amila salihan, falinafsihi." Whoever does a good action, it is for themselves. "Waman asaha faaleha." And if you sin, if you go against the rules of Allah, that's your own loss. "Wama rabbuka bidhallamin lil'abid." And God, Allah, does not do the least form of injustice to His servants. Man amila salihan fali nafsihi. If you do good, you're doing it for yourself. When we are told as Muslims that we pray five times a day, we might not know why, our parents might not know why, our teacher in our Islamic school might not know why, but as the Quran tells us, it's for your own good. And when you commit evil, it doesn't hurt anybody else. It's your own loss that you're facing. So we have to realize that benefit is for us, brothers and sisters. The third point in this journey into knowing Allah is that we need to recognize all of this. Allah, the religion, prophethood, qiyamat, imamat, all of these things have to be done because we want to know them and we want to change and be better human beings and follow the path that God has sent through the many prophets that humanity has been given. And all of this has to be done without force. As Allah says, "Inna hadaynahu sabil," in Surah Al-Insan, chapter 76, verse number 3, "Inna hadaynahu sabila imma shakiran أو إما كفورا. We have guided human beings to the way. If they're grateful, they're grateful. If they are disregarding, disbelieving, disrespecting of our rules, that's up to them. So we have to believe in this on our own volition. We can't allow, or we can't have people force us. But we have to do our own homework. And that's obviously much easier today than it was in the past. But all of us have to go down that road of struggle, of understanding our responsibilities and what are the benefits of this religion and what are the benefits more particularly of following Islam as taught by the Ahlul Bayt rather than following the Islam that other people out there today follow. Number three, and we'll come to a conclusion, is what is the outcome of having such a life? You know, as I said, that maybe you have non-Muslim friends, or maybe you have friends who are Muslims and don't practice at all. You look at them and you look at your life and you say, well, we both have nice homes. We both have nice cars. We both go on vacation. We both have the newest iPhone. We both have big screen TVs. We all have the same. But I have to fast 30 days a year. I have to pray 5 times a day. I have to spend $10,000 once in my lifetime to go for Hajj. I have to pay 20% of my savings every year as khums. I have to pay zakatul fitr. I have to do this. I have to wear hijab. I can't eat pork. I can't eat McDonald's. I can't eat KFC. I have to eat halal. I can't do this. I can't do that. I can't do this. I can't do that. So why? What is better? Why is it, you know, that I have to limit myself? What's the benefit of having this life, this God-centric life? Why worship God? It's a huge question, and I don't have all of the answers tonight. And you'll have to do your own searching and look for what is the reason why I have to, or why I follow Islam. And what should I be getting out of this religion? But if I just give you one verse, and as I wrap up for tonight, I would personally say that what Islam gives me is total freedom. Not freedom in the Western sense of the word, of being able to wear what I want and go where I want and listen to what I want and look at what I want and eat what I want and drink what I want and smoke what I want and inject what I want. But I have freedom from the society that I live in. I'm not forced to be in a bubble where I have to wear a particular brand of sneakers to fit in, or have a particular hairstyle to be cool, or I have to wear a particular brand to look, you know, to fit in with my classmates. Islam gives me the freedom to be who I am, to be free of the society that wants to impose itself on me. And let me end with this verse from chapter number 7, Surah Al-A'raf, verse 157. It's a small part of a lengthy verse, but where Allah tells us the role of the Prophet, why he sent Rasulullah. And Allah says, وَيَدَعُ عَنْهُمْ إِسْرَهُمْ وَالْأَغْلَالَ الَّتِي كَانَتْ عَلَيْهِمْ. Allah says that the role of the Rasul, of Rasulullah, the Prophet Muhammad, sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam, he removes from them the burdens and the shackles which were upon them. Now you and I don't have handcuffs, shackled. We don't have a collar around our neck. We're not slaves in that way, as we see in the history of America, which was founded on slavery and discrimination, or many of the European countries, or many other countries that were built on the backs of slaves. But the Prophet is told, or we're told rather, that the role of the Rasulullah is to break our shackles of negative culture, of the society that we live in, to allow us to be free, to allow us to worship Allah, to allow us to worship God in the way that God deserves to be worshipped. Not that we have to worship Netflix or social media or the Instagram influencers because they wear a certain style of clothing. Now, because they're an Instagram influencer, I have to follow them. Or because this Instagram influencer, she wears her hijab in a certain way, the girls follow her. And then tomorrow, unfortunately, that Instagram influencer removes her hijab. So now I feel that I have to do the same. Islam and God's centricity gives us freedom from these sorts of things, brothers and sisters. It doesn't benefit God. It benefits you in this world. And if it doesn't benefit you in this world, at least rest assured, it will benefit you in the world to come.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adi Alimun Halim Hakimun Mati. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمن
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters 6040 kilohertz for Europe and 25 meters 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat, or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
September 2nd, 2021. On the occasion of the National Government Week, President Raisi and the cabinet members met with Imam Khamenei in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya during the first days after the formation of the 30th administration.
We have an urgent matter, namely coronavirus and the issue of health. This has turned into an urgent matter that should be dealt with. Of course, the previous administration made good efforts in the area of health. They carried out good tasks and followed up the matter. They both worked on the production of vaccines inside the country and on the importation of vaccines. There are some rumours here and there, most of which are not true. Good things were done. These measures should be pursued and insisted on. Treatment, preventative measures, healthcare and testing. Testing the possibly infected patients is very important, should receive attention. These issues should definitely be dealt with. Public vaccination is a very important issue which should definitely be carried out. Another issue is imposing a smart lockdown.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
I have heard that some Western countries, which have managed to control their infection rates and whose death and infection rates are lower than ours, have closed their borders in a way that they do not even allow the people in their neighbouring country, which is also a developed country, but whose rate of infection is high, to come visit their country. In other words, they are careful. We should be really careful about controlling our borders and about preventing the new variants of this disease or other diseases from entering the country, because this is a very important matter. Of course, the people have certain responsibilities as well. As I have frequently said before, our dear people should undertake these four important responsibilities. One is wearing a mask, another is observing social distancing, the third is using good ventilation systems, and the last one is washing hands with soap. These are not difficult tasks. They are all easy. If they observe these, it will definitely be effective in reducing infection, and the high figures of death that ache one's heart will not occur.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.